Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf, using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
This is Ben Gujan with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, supported by Quad City Bank and Trust. And today I am talking art with Circa 21 Vice President Brett Hitchcock. Brett, welcome to Talking Art.
Thanks, Ben. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so excited to have you here. You were a bit of a surprise guest for me because I was scrolling online, and suddenly I saw that in the Speakeasy, which is your kind of side venue,
secondary space,
you're producing a production of Misery.
We are.
That is so exciting. I love that you're doing some theater programming in there.
Yeah, you know, the Speakeasy, we'll talk about this in a minute, maybe a little bit more about the programming later, but we were trying to get some more theatrical kinds of pieces in there. Now, we've done Rocky Horror for the last 10 years, and that was kind of the main focal point as far as a theatrical piece. Last year, we introduced a thing called Who's Holiday, which was kind of a really edgy comedy about Cindy Lou Who.
Yep,
and how she's grown up, and now she's a druggie and lives in a trailer park, and it was one of those things that could never be done at Circa, but for the Speakeasy, it was perfect. It was a great room for that. And our production manager, Jeremy Littlejohn, came to me a few months ago and said, how would you feel about doing a production of Misery? And, you know, for us, it's always, does it fit the demographic of the rooms? And each of our two rooms have completely different demographics. For the Speakeasy, it's pretty much 21 to 50-year-olds that want to come in, have a good time, have a few drinks, party it a little bit. And so they're used to more edgy programming, and that's what we do in there. And so this fit in perfectly, you know, along with Rocky Horror and Who's Holiday. I mean, this was a logical step, obviously a title that a lot of people are going to be familiar with.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're really excited to do it. We've got an amazing cast of three that are going to be very familiar to local theater audiences, and we're just really, really excited about doing it.
Well, yeah, I was so excited to see it's in there because you just did some renovations at the Speakeasy, and I have to say it's gorgeous. We hosted a concert there last year, and it's just, if you've not been to the Speakeasy yet since they've renovated, it really is beautiful what they've done. You want to tell us a little bit about?
Sure. Yeah, the space for many years, especially after Comedy Sports left, we had Comedy Sports in there for 20 years, and when it left, we decided to reopen it, rebrand it as the Speakeasy, and kind of do more of this edgy programming. And when we were doing Comedy Sports, we were primarily selling, you know, pop and candy bars. We really weren't doing much with liquor. But as we got further and further into this and started expanding our offerings in there, we started bringing in more alcohol and found out quickly that the setup that we had had for many years just was not feasible for the type of shows that we were doing now and the volume that we were doing. And so that, on top of the fact that the space needed some work. I mean, the inside of it was very dark. It needed to be, you know, to lightened up. It needed some more lighting. It just needed really a facelift. And so a couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough to be able to work with the local architect and kind of gave him what our vision for that room was, which is basically to go back and try to tie it in with Circa. You know, Circa 21 is the whole thing. You know, the building started construction in 1919, opened in 1921 during that whole Prohibition era. And so we wanted, and that was the name of the Speakeasy. So we kind of wanted to go back to a Speakeasy feel from back in the Prohibition days, but with some modern touches, obviously. So they did a wonderful job in kind of creating that vision, you know, with the bench seating that we have in there now. And that was very popular back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, the Art Deco boxes were a big thing, the sconce lighting on the walls. Those were all things that were very popular back in those days. So we brought a lot of those elements in, incorporated them into that, and with some modern touches on there too. But we were very, very happy with how it turned out. And I think the audiences over this last year and a half have really enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, it's really beautiful in there. The renovation was great, and it does have that old jazz club, Art Deco sort of vibe in there. So you alluded to this a little bit, Brett, but the history of Circa 21 is very rich.
Yes.
You said the building opened in
1921. 1921.
Hence
circa 21. So,
I never realized that was the
when Denny opened, that was the hook. So that was to kind of pay homage to the opening year of the building. So when he was trying to come up with the name for the dinner theater. So.
Sure. And when did the dinner theater open?
Dinner theater opened June 11th of 1977.
Wow.
That was his first performance, and it was the show I Do, so it was just a two-member cast.
Yeah.
The male in that particular show ended up going to Broadway and doing several shows on Broadway. I don't know of the lady in the cast, the female. I'm not sure. I think she stayed in the business for a while. She did not kind of – I don't think she achieved the kind of status that Lenny did, who was the man in the show. But, yeah, he went to New York and did several things out there and did very well. So
that's awesome. It's such a beautiful building.
Yeah.
I mean, you – both the exterior and the interior, you know, and I'm so glad that history has been able to be preserved.
And it's a tough thing, as I'm sure you understand. It's a very expensive building, and usually theaters like this are owned by municipalities,
sure,
you know, or a nonprofit organization. We are for profit, and so it's a beautiful old theater. And when Denny was looking, back in the mid '70s, where to do this. He was originally looking at what is now the Oaks Winery out in Milan.
Oh, yeah.
They had looked at that piece of property, and there was some plans, I think, in place already to perhaps level the building that was there and build something from the ground up. That's kind of the direction they were going. And then the Fort Theater, which is where we are now, opened up. It had been an adult theater in its last state for a couple of years. And when it closed, it was really kind of a dark and dingy place. It had not been kept up very well. And at the time, the Fort Armstrong, which is now the senior center across the senior retirement community across the street from us, was a hotel. They were interested in buying it to level it to make a parking lot. And at the time, the city officials didn't want that to happen. And I think some of the family of the original architects were still around at that time, I believe, and didn't want to see that happen to that beautiful building either. So they were looking for anybody to come in to do something with it. And Dave Weiner, who's a local realtor, has been for many years. That's who Denny was working with, along with Bob Swanson at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they heard that this building was open and suggested that that Denny go down and take a look at it, and walked around and knew right away that this is where he wanted to set up shop and where he wanted to do this dinner theater. So, and it's really neat because we have a National Dinner Theater Association group that has members all over the country. And I think we are the only one right now that is set up in a real theater. Most of them are either ground up, newer facilities, or we have some friends in Pennsylvania and Florida that have theaters that were like in an old grocery store. They had switched that over and manipulated that and made a theater out of that. But I think we're the only ones that have a true theater that we're performing in. And
Was it originally a theater?
It was a movie theater. It was a movie theater in Vaudeville House.
Yeah.
And in its day, I mean, it was a very popular. I mean, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, Dale Evans were in for openings. There was other movie stars of the time that would come in for openings of movies in the Quad Cities. And I think a lot of it had to do with the Rock Island Line and the railroad there. I mean, it was more popular. And so they would come in and be here for these openings. So, I mean, it's the history that building has. Is just amazing. And all of the people that have been through there over the years and have performed there, not only when it was still a movie in Vaudeville House, but, you know, even after Denny acquired it, we had Tony Bennett twice. You know, we've had the Smothers Brothers, Phyllis Diller, you know, so there's a lot of very famous people that have performed on that stage or in that building since 1921.
And that's always so cool to me. I did some touring performing for a while. And when you would go to a town and go into a theater that had the kind of history like that, you know, like a Westport Playhouse in Connecticut or Tarrytown or I'm not remembering the name of the theater, but the one up in Rockford, that's the
Clock Tower. Clock Tower?
Yeah. Like you just walk in and you feel that history.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the, you know, for lack of a better word, the ghosts of those old performers
who
are still in that space and bringing it to life. And I mean, when I've gone and seen shows at Circa, like you feel that, you know, the architecture, the space, like this is a place where people come together and watch shows and entertainment.
It has been a real privilege and honor to be able to do shows and produce shows in a space that has so much history.
Yeah.
And it is a really, really cool old building. And, you know, it's got its fun little nooks and crannies that most of the general public don't get into. And, you know, upstairs in the balcony still has the original balcony seats from when we opened. Right now it's more of a storage area, but it's really funny to go back and look at that and you can see really how our society is was much smaller back then in size, because, you know, I'm 6'5" and I weigh about 250. I can barely get into one of those seats, yes. You know, and they're so narrow. And I, you know, being 6'5", you know, I have a problem anyway, but I have to throw my legs over the seat in front of me because the seats are so close together back to back. Because back in 1921, as a society, we were smaller and people could fit into those seats. Now it's just, it's crazy. But just to look at some of that, you know, the history of like that and see that, or see the, you know, the Indian influence that's all over that building, you know, and that was the architects really wanted to pull from the Indian heritage from around this area when they were putting it together. And you can see that all over the interior. And it's really, if you look closely, it's all over the exterior of the building as well. So,
it's really so cool. And I remember sitting in New York theaters, and even as a 6-footer, just feeling that like I am cramped.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
Need to get an aisle seat so I can kick my legs out from time to time.
Exactly. So it's an interesting thing to see, you know, to see all those rows like that and just how they used to pack. And I believe it sat in its heyday between the two levels. It sat 1577. Or right around there. So, I mean, it seated a lot of people. Yeah. And it seems that there are so many local residents that still remember it as a movie theater. You know, they went to go see movies as a kid. And we had somebody that came a couple years ago that said, I used to sneak up the fire escapes. And I would sneak in the balcony door and go and sit and watch a movie. And people had their first dates. We had some couples that had their first date there back in the day. And,
It's
really, I mean, people come in and so many people have a tie to that building from growing up, you know, either having memories of going to see movies with their parents or, again, you know, on a date or with friends. And so it holds a lot of memories, real cherished memories for a lot of people in this market. So besides us.
I'm always really interested about the business side of the arts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there aren't a lot of dinner theaters.
Right.
Like there's a
handful of us, but there's not hundreds of us. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Denny originally founded it, was how did it happen that he decided to do a dinner theater rather than just
at the time that he was looking at, he was actually teaching in Augustana. He was he was working in the theater department at Augustana. He had been hired. My parents moved here in 1969. Denny was on a 1-year contract with Augie while another professor had taken the year off. They created a position for him after he came back. And so when he was still at Augie, he attended a conference. I don't remember if it was in Minneapolis or perhaps it was on the East Coast. One of the sessions that was happening at this conference was a session on dinner theater. And at that time, there were not many dinner theaters in the northern states. It was primarily something in the southern states.
Sure.
And so he went in, he listened to this presentation. They talked about demographic, psychographic, you know, which areas it worked best in. And the more they kept talking about where these work, to him, the more they were describing the Quad Cities.
Right.
And so he came back and you know, did some real soul searching and decided that's really what he wanted to do with his life. And so he went about trying to, you know, put a business plan together and then went out looking for money. And that proved to be very difficult. And it's in every time I go out and do a speaking engagement to like a Rotary group or a Kiwanis group or something like that, somebody will come up inevitably after it's done and say, my name is so-and-so. I'm a former banker, a retired banker in the area. And Denny came to us looking for money back when he was trying to put this package together, and we told him he was nuts, you know, because you're looking at two things that have a propensity to fail, you know, restaurants and theaters, neither one of them, you know, usually last too terribly long, and a lot of them fail. And so you want to take these two concepts and you want to blend them together. Well, you're nuts. You know, we're not giving you any money for that. So luckily he found a couple of sympathetic bankers in town and then some investors in the area. And so they got the money together and got it open. But I think that's where it came from. He attended this conference and really felt like, you know, that one-stop shopping concept of having, you know, your dinner and your entertainment all in one location would be something that would be very appealing to people.
Yeah.
And here we are almost 50 years later, and it's still the case.
Yeah, and I mean the way you run the evening, you know, with dinner being served and the desserts and the coffee and you know, the way it weaves in without the show. And I mean, you guys are unique with the bootleggers.
Yeah. We're only one of two dinner theaters in the country that have a performing wait staff. And so, you know, the bootleggers are a real integral part of the whole experience. And most of that staff has, you know, musical theater degrees or vocal degrees already. And so there's a lot of them that have gone off and done other shows. We had one, Sarah Hayes, who is temporarily gone right now. She was out on the tour of Hairspray for a year. So, I mean, she was gone.
Awesome.
So we've had several that have gone off and done other either tours, national tours, or gone to work for other theaters and come back. Over the years, we've had a lot that we had a guy named Dean Banowitz, whose family was from Maquoketa. He was a bootlegger for us, and he was a hairstylist. He ended up moving to L.A. Back in the 80s and became kind of hairstylist to the stars. I mean, I haven't heard from him for a while, but he was doing Ryan Seacrest's hair, and he was on the show. So he was doing all of the people on the show and you know, really working with a lot of famous people. So, you know, there's been several of those bootleggers over the years that have kind of graduated from being a bootlegger and really gone on to really great things. So, and again, as you mentioned, they're a very integral part of what we do with their pre-show beforehand. They have a 15-minute musical review that they do before every performance, and it changes for every show. And it's just a really, really talented group of people because they're not your typical waiters. They're not just bringing you coffee or bringing you dessert or bringing you food. They are doing that. But in addition to that, they're getting up on stage and they're entertaining you, which is where it's completely different than most waiters. So,
yeah. And I mean, how great for, you know, it's the theater as an actor is such a brutal business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say as a director and producer, like the easiest thing for me to replace is an actor in a show of all the positions.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're getting out of college and trying to find your way and trying to find out how you're going to make a career to, you know, this can be a way to get your foot in the door somewhere or just start to get that professional experience.
Working in the arts, I think, in general, as I'm sure you well know, and probably everybody that's listening that is in the arts knows, you don't get in the arts to get rich.
No.
It's a labor of love. And I think that's exactly what it is for professional actors. I mean, it's a lot of people are interested, you know, that don't know a lot about how actors work, that, you know, when this contract is done here for us, if they don't have another contract, they go back home to wherever it is that they are setting up base, and they're working temp jobs. They're doing anything they can to make enough money to live until they get the next acting contract.
Yeah.
And then they're going and doing that. And, you know, living in New York or trying to set up shop in New York is so expensive, you know, trying to be in Manhattan, that a lot of actors have kind of now left that and have kind of set up in other areas like this, you know, where they set up base here because the cost of living is so much less and they can still travel around the country and go do other things, but they're not having to have, you know, three or four roommates, you know, and living in Manhattan to be able to wing it and working two jobs to do it. So it's really a difficult God bless them for doing it, but it's a very difficult living, a way to make a living. Again, and relationships are very difficult for them too, because it's very rare that you have a couple that can continuously work together at the same theaters. Oftentimes they're having to split up and go different directions, and you may not see each other for several months. And so it really truly is a labor of love. I mean, you have to love what you're doing to do that in order to keep it going. So.
Yeah, well, I always say, you know, the job of being an actor is getting the next job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
The acting part I'll do for free.
Sure. Yep.
Yep. I mean, I won't. But, but like, that's the fun. I think it was a Samuel L. Jackson quote, and it's been attributed to other people, but like, I act for free. They pay me to wait around.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Well, in the movies, there's plenty of waiting around, too.
Yes.
That's certainly something that you've got a lot of downtime, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved in, obviously your father started the theater.
My father started the theater.
Did you just grow up in the theater and...
Well, that really is, I think that's pretty much how it went, you know, because I remember being with him before the theater opened, and there's a lot of, he wanted to have a lot of period kind of furniture in there that would kind of fit that era. And so before the theater opened, I remember going with him and a couple of other people that were friends of his to auctions all over this area.
Sure.
Where he was buying furniture and bringing the furniture in and getting it set up. And I remember going in with him on weekends. This was, when he opened, I was four.
Okay.
And so I remember going in with him as I got a little bit older on weekends, and you know, he would say, we just have to go in for a half an hour. I have to do a couple things and we'll get out of here. And about 2.5 hours later, we would actually leave. So, you know, during that time, there was a lot of opportunity to just kind of run around the building, you know, and just kind of get used to it. And so I was so used to being there, and I hadn't, when I was in junior high and even early in high school, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I mean, I was involved with the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got older, it started to, I think, resonate with me more that maybe I want to do this. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be on the stage or off the stage. And I remember doing shows. I'm a graduate of Sherrard.
Okay.
And so I remember doing shows at Sherrard for Tom Sweigel back in the 80s. And I always was wondering, I think my freshman through my junior year, why I was always stuck in these ensemble roles and way in the back. And it wasn't like I wanted any favors because of my father or anything like that. I wanted to earn my way.
Sure.
But I thought, geez, you know what? Am I not very good? Is this a nice way of telling me that maybe you're not the best and this is why you're in the back behind everybody else? And my senior year, we did Oliver, and I was in the show right next to a lady that has worked for us a lot over the years, from another professional actress named Andrea Moore, and we were doing this show, and unfortunately, somebody videotaped it. And so I went back afterwards and watched this videotape, and I thought, now I know why Tom Sweagle put me in the back in every show, because I was god awful. And so that was the light bulb for me, that if I was going to do this, that it had to be on the administrative side or on the sales side. It was not going to be on the stage, or I was going to go broke, because there was no way that I was going to be able to do that. And so I think that's kind of where it came from at that point. And then I moved away for a little bit to Minnesota and came back and started in the I started in 93, I believe, 93, 94, right around there. But I had done jobs growing up. So I feel like I kind of paid my dues. I mean, he had me doing things in the summer, like around, there used to be a flower shop called the Garden Shop on the main level that we rented out space to. It was a separate business. Around those windows are copper. Mm-hmm. And there had been they had been tarnished over for about 50 years. So I spent a summer with Tarnex and scrub brushes scrubbing this stuff off of this window to get this copper back out there.
Sure.
And, I think he was paying me far less than minimum. And I went to him one day and I said, you know, this is junk work, man. Come on, can you pay me a little bit more? And he said, go to Sharon, who was our business manager at the time, who was a very good business manager because she was good with the money.
Yeah.
And she said, you convince Sharon. You and Sharon talk about it. Whatever she's willing to pay you, I'll go along with. And I didn't even go upstairs because I knew she wasn't going to give me any more. So I kept scrubbing the Tarnex in for that. I spent another summer at our building in Davenport where we build the sets, mm-hmm. taking out old hardware and screws and things like that. So I spent another summer. The basement of the Speakeasy was a building that Denny acquired several years before Comedy Sports came along. And he swapped the back end of that building for the front end of what is now our costume shop. Well, we had to clean out the basement, which was full of stuff. So I spent another summer with Tony Dexter, who's in town. He was an actor. He works out, I know, at Countryside a lot.
Yeah.
And so he and I spent a summer cleaning out this basement of this building, throwing stuff into a dumpster, which was just hard work. And so I really feel like I kind of paid my dues and kind of worked my way up, got into the business. I was bussing tables for a while. I did Spotlight for a show. So I feel like over the 31 years, I've really kind of worked my way up. And, you know, you still have – there was still the whole nepotism thing, you know, going in that I think anybody would deal with, you know, when I first started.
Yeah.
And who's this young punk that, you know, of course he's going to come in and take a position that he's probably three levels, you know, below. But, you
right.
know, but I think I think being there and growing up in the business mm-hmm. Really helped with that too, because I understood everything about it. I understood the business. You know, I understood the theatrical side. I understood the business side. I understood the production side of it. So I came into it at least with a lot more knowledge, I think, than some. And so, you know, just been kind of plugging away over the years. And, you know, no one is successful without a good staff. And we have, Denny has always had a really solid staff around all of us, you know, and working as a team, it just makes it much easier and much better for everybody.
Well, and that's so important, I think, in theater. You know, there are very few people, I think, who can cobble together a theater career just, I am just an actor.
Right.
And that's all I do.
Yeah.
You know, it's been so important, I know, through my years as a theater artist to be able to build a set, to paint a set, mm-hmm. to direct, to stage manage, to do all the different jobs that it takes.
And oftentimes especially with small companies where you're talking about, you know, three or four people, you have to do that.
Yes.
You have to have that skill set or it's not going to happen. So you have to be able to do all that.
And I'm the director and the producer and the scenic painter.
All those hats.
And the janitor.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, it's not always a glamorous job. I probably have spent more time in the basement with the HVAC system and with our heating system than probably anybody that's ever worked for us. And so, you know, I've been down there where there's been water backups and other kinds of backups. And, you know, you learn how to do everything. And I think, you know, multitasking, I think, is important regardless of where you're at and whatever business you're into. The more you know, the more valuable you are. And so we try to preach that as well. But learning everything about the business, I think, was incredibly important at a young age to be able to understand it. And, you know, when people come to you with problems, you know, you understand what they're saying instead of, you know, it being out of left field or something you don't ever deal with. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming to you with an issue that you may or may not understand. Well, yeah, I've done that. So I understand that how that could be a problem, you know, and what do we need to do to fix it? So. Yeah.
Well, and so talking about that business side, like, you know, obviously there's always the dichotomy in theater of the art versus the business side of it.
Exactly.
How do you guys balance that with, you know, with your season selection and,
well,
obviously the dinner part adds a whole other revenue stream.
Right.
But
yeah, specifically with the shows, that probably is the single most difficult thing that we do.
Sure.
The biggest decision we make for the whole year, because those shows drive everything else. People aren't coming to us just to eat. You know, we're not a restaurant in a sense. So the reason that
the food's very good.
Thank you very much. Yes. Our chef, Tony, is very good, and he's coming up with some wonderful things. But they're coming to see the shows. You know, the food is just another aspect of that evening. But if we don't pick the shows right, you know, people aren't going to come. And then it doesn't matter how good our food is or how good the bootleggers are or anything else. If the shows aren't right, if the shows aren't appealing to people, no one's coming. And so, you know, it's a real balance to try to come up with those things, because we can only do, you know, the old war horses, the Sound of Music's, a Fiddler on the Roofs, you know, the Music Man's, all of those. You can only do those so much.
Right.
And people want a mix of old and new. You know, so you need to balance that some of those older shows that have name recognition against some newer works that maybe they haven't heard of or maybe new. And, you know, there are still people that like plays more than musicals. We have found not a lot. The majority of our audience really is into the musicals more than they are the plays. But we do have a core of our audience, a percentage of our audience that really enjoys the plays. So we try to do one play a year, which is what we're in the middle of right now with Baskerville. And then the majority are musicals. But, you know, it's a real balancing act. And Denny does a good job of kind of looking at the whole pie. You know, so let's look at this in terms of the production. You know, how many actors is this going to be? How much are the royalties for the show going to be? How big does this set have to be? You know, and then we look on the sales side, you know, how much are we going to have to market this? Is this a title that people know? You know, are we going to have to allocate more money, you know, because it's a title that is a newer title that people may not have heard of? We've got to spend more money in marketing, you know? So we look at all of those factors, and we kind of come up with a pool of shows after we kind of wind it all down. And then really it's up to Denny. At that point, it's up to him. He's gotten the input from the other production people, from the sales staff, you know, the food and beverage staff. Then he just has to go back and just make the decision, you know.
Sure.
And again, I think it's probably the single most difficult decision that he makes all year. But luckily, he's kind of perfected it. And, you know, have there been some clunkers along the way? Absolutely. But I think any theater can say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily, over 50 years, we've had a few more highs and we've had lows. And that's why we're still here. So.
Well, I know you and I spoke another time, and you talked about having that association of other dinner theaters, mm-hmm. that you guys are able to share information of, like, this show works well or sells well for us, that you're able to swap that. You know, looking at your brochure right now, you're doing a fairly new show, Come From Away, which is a really exciting new show. And
we are really excited about that. And, you know, I think I've been surprised personally how many people in this market are familiar with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's run a lot of places, and for, you know, a lot of people, what we were afraid was, and what the show is, for people that don't know, it's a show that takes place on 9/11, and it's a story about all of these people that were in the air, that when they closed the U.S. airspace, there were thousands of people that were stranded in this little town in Newfoundland, and they weren't prepared for anything. And so all these planes just started landing at this little airport, and all the hundreds of people are getting off with no food and no shelter and things like that. And it's all about these little towns all around there that took all of these people in. And it has just a beautiful score, and it's a beautiful story. But it's education too, in the sense that, you know, when people hear 9/11, they think of New York or Shanksville or the Pentagon. And so it's an education as well to let them know this is not that. You know, this is a beautiful story about humanity helping humanity at one of the worst times in our country's history. And so it's a beautiful piece. And I have been pleasantly surprised again how many people in this market are familiar with it, and a lot of buzz. you know, which is great. So
it's a great show. I know I was very excited to see you guys were doing it. And it's fairly new. Like, this is the first year it's been available. Because when was it on Broadway? 2017?
Oh, I don't remember offhand.
2018, something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just coming out and available for
Theaters our size, and so Denny jumped all over it, and you know, there are shows that you know he's got on the list that we can just never get. Chicago's a perfect example of that. We've been trying to get Chicago for 20 years,
sure.
You know, but it sits in Chicago and it sits in these big sit down productions, or it's touring all the time. And the last non-union tour that was out last year, we knew the producer. He's a friend of ours that owns a dinner theater in Fort Myers, Florida, and in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
and so Denny called him and said, "Hey, are you taking Chicago out again next year?" And he said, "No, we're not taking it out again." And he gave us his blessing to the royalty houses to get the rights. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten the rights, you know, because they still had it somewhat locked up. And so, you know, it's you know, finding a show that you think is going to work. And if you can't get it right away, you've got to stick with it. And, you know, you also being in theater know that, you know, sometimes, you know, they can hold you up for the craziest reasons, you know, why you're not going to get the rights to do something you really want to do. Or this is the perfect show to round out our season, and you get a no, you know, and you got to go back to square one. So, but Chicago, after 20 some odd years, we were really thrilled to get that one too. And our advance on that is really strong. And we've got an amazing cast coming in from all over the country for that. So we're really excited about that. And that opens up in early May.
That's awesome. So, I think your theater is perfect for Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Because
it's a vaudeville, the whole feel in that era. Yep. Yeah, for sure. So
What else do you have this season?
Well, we are getting ready to close Baskerville on March 8th. And then after that, we're opening on March 12th a show called Heartbreak Hotel, which was on Broadway a few years ago, but with a different title. It was called Elvis.
Yeah.
And it did very well. It was successful. And I don't know where in the process, but the estate got involved, Elvis's estate. And said, "No, we're not down for this name being used for a show." So they had to change the name to Heartbreak Hotel. But what this is a wonderful show about the life of Elvis, starting from younger all the way through, you know, the 68 comeback special. And so it really follows his entire life. It's alive. We have a live band on stage. We've got this wonderful actor coming in to do Elvis for us that has done it all over the country. So we're really excited about that. And, you know, we don't oftentimes have a live band on stage. And so we're really excited to be able to have that again. And so that opens up on March 12th, runs through early May. Then again, Chicago comes in after that.
Yeah.
And then midsummer, opening on the 9th of July, we're doing Mary Poppins.
Oh, awesome.
And that's another one, too, where, you know, we hadn't done it. And, you know, for a while we were doing other shows, and more friends of ours, as we were talking about that National Dinner Theater Group, more of our friends in the industry were starting to do it. And when we would go to these conferences once a year, we kind of compare shows, you know, what shows sold, what shows didn't. Well, Mary Poppins started to kind of pop up on there more as something that more people were doing and more people were having success with.
Yeah.
One of our concerns was that people were going to perceive it as a kid show.
Oh,
because we have a children's theater as well. And we've had some issues over the years where people perceived a regular main stage show to be a kid's show. And the one that comes to mind was Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. We had a beautiful production of Peter Pan several years ago, but a lot of people were thinking it was a kid's show, and so they weren't coming. So, you know, so we were concerned about Mary Poppins possibly having the same effect. But thus far, our advance is really strong on that too. And our matinees are really full already. And so I think that hopefully that's going to be a big hit for us too. And then rounding out the year then is Come From Away. So we're really excited about the season. So
it's an exciting season, and I'm so glad to see you guys thriving, especially with all the construction in downtown Rock Island.
Yes, it is. And we tell our staff, you know, it's very frustrating. We do have some clients that have decided to not come back until they can get right up front again, and that's fine. But what we're telling everybody is, you know, look at the big picture. I think that if you look at the architectural designs, once that gets done, it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to help attract new business, and we'll be able to retain them. And Rock Island, downtown Rock Island especially, has needed a facelift for a long time. I mean, it had its heyday in the 90s with the district and the festivals that were happening down there. And then, you know, that kind of festival scene has kind of dried up for a lot of these local ones. You know, the district festivals, the Blues Fest, a lot of those have just gone away now.
Yeah.
And so You know, but to be able to give it a facelift now and to a whole new look, I think it's $8+ million that the city is spending. And yeah. I think that when it's done, it's going to be beautiful. And I'm looking forward to that. And that's what we just keep telling our staff is, you know, yes, we're all frustrated that you know, nothing is happening. But once it gets done, it's going to be really special. I mean, the lighting's going to be better. It's going to be much more inviting and hopefully draw a lot more foot traffic, which is what we need in the downtown.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
one thing you mentioned earlier about Heartbreak Hotel, mm-hmm. talking about the guy playing Elvis, and I think this is something that maybe not a lot of outside of theater people know or think about. You know, you're saying this guy's played at all over the country. Uh-huh. There, especially with these sort of jukebox musicals where people have to play, like, there's a very small segment of performers that can carry that off.
Absolutely.
And so these people that fall into the role of, I'm playing Elvis, or I'm playing this role in Million Dollar Quartet.
Yep.
And then they just travel around the country doing that show.
That's exactly
right. From regional theater to regional theater. You know,
we had that happen several times. Well, most recently with Jersey Boys.
Sure.
Several of the members of our cast of Jersey Boys have gone out to do it at a few other theaters now. And, you know, you're exactly right. You know, if you can do one of those famous characters, you know, and you can do it well, you can and you're good to work with. And I think that's a lot of times that's what people, if you're bad to work with or if you're grouchy or you're a drama queen.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to work as much. But if you're good to work with and you're good at the role, you're right. You can certainly take that and you can go do the show as many times as you want to do it. So,
yeah,
until you get burned out.
And, I remember being in working at a summer stock when I was first kind of starting my acting career and working with this guy on Guys and Dolls who kind of did that with the role of Nicely Nicely Johnson. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a big round guy who could sing higher than God and do cartwheels.
Yep.
And people loved him. And so he would just go from theater to theater.
Yep.
Playing Nicely Nicely somewhere.
Yeah.
You know?
It's crazy, but that it's good. It's job security for them.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as they don't get burned out doing it, you know, that's heck yeah, they can do it. And especially if you can get onto a tour, you know, with the tours, you're making a lot of money and not a lot of places to spend it because you're just bouncing around on a bus, you know?
Yeah.
So.
No, I remember friends just getting those per diems.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, combining their hotel money and just sock it away.
You can sock it away. Yeah, that's right.
For the dry season in between.
Exactly. Exactly.
Brett, thank you again for being my guest today on Talking Art. Thanks again to Quad City Bank and Trust for their support and to our producer, Mark. And for more information and tickets for Misery or any of the shows we talked about today, you can visit www.circa21.com. I'm Ben Goujon, and this was Talking Art.